Thank you for your kindness and generosity to me and my wife and my grandchild, Percy. We have made memories this week we'll never forget. I hope maybe she'll remember somewhere back into her two-year-old mind when she's an adult. The images and shadows of this place. We've had a wonderful time. You can be seated. Thank you for standing. My theme for this morning has an unusual source of inspiration. In a widely publicized interview, Ted Turner, billionaire husband of Jane Fonda, the owner of the Atlanta Braves and TBS, called Christianity a religion for losers. And this may be the only statement Turner has ever made with which I agree. In the time I have today, I'd like to explain to you why I think this might be the most fitting summary of the way the New Testament church understood itself. So in 1857, archaeologists discovered on Rome's Palatine Hill a building that once served as a boarding school for boys in the first and second centuries AD. On one of the walls of the boarding school, they discovered what is now called the Graffito Blasfemo, or the blaspheming graffiti. I'd like you to come with me now, back 20 centuries in time, and stand with me here near that wall of that old boarding school amid the laughter of boys running in the hall, teachers writing on the chalkboard, a chorus of voices repeating the Roman alphabet. Watch two boys looking over their shoulders to make sure no one else is looking. Watch them sneer, and then etch deep into the wall the picture of a crucified donkey and a boy beneath the crucifixion raising his hand in worship towards the donkey. And in crude letters, they etch the words, Alexamenos worships his God, or Alex worships his God. My work here is much like those 19th century archaeologists. I'm going to try to remove for a little bit this morning the layers of history that has seen Christianity transform from a band of rejects into a religion with nearly 3 billion adherents today. I want you to see our faith for a moment, not through our eyes, but through the mocking eyes of those two boys 20 centuries ago. And I'd also like to compare the two religions, the religion of Christianity and the religion of Rome in the first century. And I'd like us to consider from this vantage their respective prospects. See which of the two should survive the passing of time. Let's begin with Christianity of the first century. Let's consider Jesus, the founder of the Christian faith. And he was, according to the fact checkers of the day, a criminal. Rome knew how to handle those who put peace at risk. Once upon a time, some years before Christ, some 100 years in fact, a certain popular slave fell into the hands of Marcus Licinius Crassus. This great Roman triumvir lined 70 miles of the Appian Way with crosses, crucified all of the rebels. He warned all would-be rebels in the future just how dangerous it is to plot sedition against Rome. Pontius Pilate, it would seem, from this vantage, made a perfectly sensible political maneuver when he turned Jesus over to his accusers. He understood, Pilate did, that the peace of a region is far more important than the innocence or guilt of one solitary man. And if you take issue with Pilate's moral calculus, ask the mothers of sons lost in senseless wars whether the punishment of one questionable and fringy foreigner is worth one less war. And what of Jesus' mourners? Were there many? Absolutely not. The slave Spartacus had 6,000. He had 6,000 followers, and he and they were hung on 6,000 crosses. But what of Jesus? How many of his followers were willing to die on Golgotha with him? The evangelists record that he was crucified between two strangers. The contingent of those who came in sympathy of Jesus was so small that Jesus' mother represented 25% of the crowd. His maternal aunt represented another 25%. And 75% of the audience was named Mary. Even the noonday sun, we are told, decided to be absent. The only male present was a kind of dreamy devotee, the kind of young, misguided eccentric that always seems to follow around cult criminals like Barabbas and Charles Manson and Pablo Escobar. Men these youngsters deem as merely misunderstood. But surely, the most startling absence on that day was the absence of God. All theological and Christological explanations aside, Christians should not so easily explain away the so-called cry of dereliction. Only a religion of losers would base its faith on a God who sounded, if only for a moment, as if he too were an atheist. And yet, this is what Christianity did. It doesn't sound promising in the first century. How about Christianity's chief apostle, the Apostle Peter? Let's look at him for a moment outside the lens of later time and, again, from the perspective of the first century Roman. What kind of loser do we have here? One night he swears he'll always come to his master's defense no matter the cost. The very next night, as a unit of soldiers comes to arrest this irritant Jesus, Peter so ably defends his master that he takes a swing not at one of the arresting soldiers. No, he's so incompetent that he directs his attack at an unarmed slave. And at close quarters, he aims for the head, but as usual, Peter misses. Ready, fire, aim. That's his personality. So nicely captured here in Gethsemane. He abandons the one to whom 24 hours earlier he swore an undying allegiance. This is, from Rome's vantage point, incredibly un-Roman. But is this the end of Peter's disgraceful night? No. In this comedy of errors, he is at least one more show of incompetence. Outside City Hall, while his master's standing bound and shivering on this cold, late winter, early spring twilight, powerful enemies all around, Peter is caught warming himself by a fire. Three figures accuse him of being one of Jesus' disciples. Are these powerful interrogators? Not in the least. The first accusation comes from a slave. And please, I want you to note, the text of John draws particular attention to the fact that it was a slave girl, not a woman, and not just a slave, but a slave girl who would have had no standing whatsoever in the ancient world. Peter the Great, Peter the Saint, Peter the Shepherd, Peter the Prince, Peter the Rock. Here he is, disarmed and rendered utterly craven by a mere girl. To put Peter's cowardice in further perspective, while he's busy distancing himself from Jesus, Judas Iscariot heads back to Caiaphas's house, where he will publicly, and at greatest risk to himself, confess his sins and the innocence of Jesus, where he's supposed to, in the temple. His contrition is so complete that to secure Jesus' freedom, he's even willing to part with his ill-gotten coins, the one thing we're told he loves more than anything else. The difference between Peter and Judas? Peter might have been sorrowful once the cock crowed, but he lived to see the celebration at Pentecost, only because he was less remorseful than Judas. Only a religion for losers would choose a Peter, such a man, to deliver its inaugural address. And yet this is just what Christianity did. How about the Apostle Paul, the man most responsible for Christianity's theological underpinnings? This man, from the first century perspective, has loser written all over him. He's named after the tallest man in Israel. But if his nickname Paulus or Tiny is any indication, he was, as I mentioned the other day, unusually slight and feeble and unimpressive. Let's look him over critically. Probably the most clownish moment in his career comes early on, or is displayed early on, in Luke's narrative of the history of the early church. What was Paul thinking in telling the story of how he had to escape his assailants by being lowered from the city wall in Damascus in a basket? The highest honor a Roman soldier can have or be given by the state is the honor called the Coronis Moralis. This is the medal given to the soldier who is the first to risk his life and climb over the city's wall and into the city. This is the Iron Cross of the ancient world. The first soldier over the city wall and into the enemy city. It's almost as if Paul is telling a story here of a kind of comical parody of the honorable Roman soldier. Anyone with sense in the first century would tell a story of how they climbed the wall and stormed into the enemy city, but not Paul. Just look at him, clownishly crouched in a basket, dropping inch by inch from a rope and finally landing, but on the wrong side of the wall. Running away from, instead of bravely into, danger. Romans were strong and proud. They picked up the world by the scruff of the neck and gave it progress, whether the world wanted it or not. But it's almost as if Paul gloried in what Romans would be ashamed of. He wallowed in weakness. And if none of this is sufficient to persuade you of Paul's status from the first century perspective as a loser, consider that his chief opponents came from the ranks of his own people, fellow Jews and Christians. From his own pen, we learn that he was beaten within an inch of his life by his own people 5 times. He left no city without helping himself to a full treatment of its prison system. No sooner had Paul left a congregation to go somewhere else than this congregation apparently would trip over itself, looking to find better preachers. While other more sensible men inspired their audiences with sermons filled with visions of the third heaven, Paul stubbornly insisted that the grandest vision of God, the grandest vision of God that you could ever have, was seeing God hanging in bodily form from a cross. From the Roman perspective, Paul shamelessly fetishized what everyone else had the good sense to despise. Most audiences are taken in with grand visions of glory. Give them a strong God, a cunning God, a reasonable God, a wise God, a Roman God. Who wants to make a claim that a weak God capable of bleeding and dying was their maker? The Romans wanted to believe that they were descended from a God above all of that. And whatever you do, avoid offending the people's sensibilities by depicting a God who reminds them they're sinners. But not Paul. He never had the gift of learning how to harness people's desire to be flattered. And the more his vision repulsed people, and the more they begged for a higher and more satisfying vision of God, the more Paul determined to know nothing except Christ and Him crucified. He even admitted his own preaching was foolish. It's as if it never occurred to him that life in this world is ugly enough, but Paul had to make heaven ugly too and fill it with a bleeding God. And at the climax of his insane grotesqueries, he fantasized that he was being crucified with Christ. For the Romans, this was pathetic. We won't even go into that episode at Troas where he literally bored a listener to death. Only a religion for losers would allow such a man's musings to fill its holy book, and yet Christianity did. Prospects are not good. But now let's turn our attention to Christianity's rival, Rome, and the religion of Rome. The religion of the Roman Empire, like the empire itself, was built to last forever. The religion of Rome was practiced as far west as Spain and as far east as what is today the borders of Iran. It built impressive temples and brought wealth and riches to cities far and wide. But a Rome and its religion of winners, not losers, comes at a great cost. Rome was supposed to give dignity to its sons and daughters. It taught them the value of civic and familial virtue. A religion for winners places examples of strength before its children. The gods are strong and beautiful and flawless, and fathers and mothers are the picture of strength, and the Roman Caesar is supposed to be, as father of his nation and God to his kingdom, a mirror of both. But in truth, no other civilization save perhaps the Carthaginians and the Canaanites practiced the art of infanticide the way Rome did. Roman fathers regarded their daughters as little more than a nuisance and routinely had their infant daughters strangled, drowned, or left out on a hillside to be eaten by wild animals. This practice in the second century reached such prevalence that according to extant census records, only one in 60 Roman families had more than one daughter. And the ratio of men to women in the empire was, by some estimates, something like 60% men and 40% women, which is a massive distortion of natural ratios. Without this kind of interference, is normally around 50-50. Romans didn't usually permit children with severe physical defects to live. The only way Rome could be strong was to rid itself of the weak. Most of the Roman populace consisted of slaves, and the vast majority of the slave children were pressed into prostitution, little girls for the brothels, servicing the men of the warrior and equestrian classes, little boys who would serve as malakoi, or passive sexual partners, for the most respectable Roman patricians. The strongest slaves of Rome were forced to become gladiators, who had a life expectancy of 27. But the citizens needed entertainment. Sure, this might all sound a little unpleasant, but we've got an empire to build and a religion for winners to sustain. Rome's Caesars were the picture of wisdom and a sound mind, right? Which is probably why Julius Caesar was a megalomaniac. Tiberius's greatest joy, he said, was soaking in his spa with children. Caligula was a paranoid schizophrenic who literally married his horse and took pleasure in kissing his wife's neck and whispering, "So beautiful a neck must be cut whenever I please." He invited one day all of the senators to a banquet. And upon their arrival, they saw the windows covered by black drapes. The walls were painted black, the floor black, the table black, the plates, the candles, the silverware, all black. The foods on the plate, they were all black, each dish garnished by a small black tombstone. It wasn't Halloween. It was Caligula's dinner party from hell. The senators dined believing that this was their last supper. They ate mysteriously blackened meat for the main course, while Caligula feasted on fear. Claudius was a raging anti-Semite, but the most normal of all of the first century emperors. Nero. He had himself declared God in his lifetime. He castrated a boy named Sporus and then married him. And then he copulated with his mother. The emperor Domitian enjoyed being a part of religion, of Rome's religion for winners, so much that as he stared out upon vistas of boredom, he whiled away the hours of his life stabbing flies with his stylus for fun. While Christians were creeping down into dark secret places, carrying the light and future of the world, Rome was busy leaving no perversion untried, no blasphemy unspoken, no creeping thing unworshipped, no cruelty unpracticed. There arose in the first century a cult, or this religion that I keep referring to, of the worship of the divine emperors, or the Divii Geulii. There was a whole priesthood for this cult of the emperors, which worshipped the emperors. Their job was to coerce the populations, especially of the eastern half of the empire, into worshiping these Caesars as gods. The priests of this religion built temples dedicated to divine Caesar and enforced mandatory pledges in their names. But in due course, the cult began to wane somewhat. The succession of miserable emperors, culminating in Nero and the year of the four emperors, Otho, Galba, Vitellius, and Vespasian, drained the populace of enthusiasm. The hand of vengeance found the bed to which the purple tyrant fled. The iron hand crushed the tyrant's head, became tyrant in his stead. So the imperial cult devised new schemes for generating revenue and awe for this dying religion. So they hired a few clever propagandists. And one later particularly egregious example of Rome's commitment to propping up state-sponsored Caesar worship came in the form of a certain man by the name of Hieron of Alexandria. He was an engineer who had recently invented a series of mechanical marvels. First, he designed a machine he called an aeolipile. It was a steam engine prototype. Second, he invented the world's first vending machine. Third, he invented a fountain that operated autonomously using hydrostatic electricity. Fourth, he invented a suite of machines designed specifically for theater, mechanical marionettes that could perform on command, fly through the air, dance, mime. He invented a thunder generator, pyrotechnics, and fireworks. All of these automated and governed by hidden programmable timing devices run on steam engine power. The imperial priests of the emperors exploited these devices. They hired and they purchased these devices from Hieron. And then they had them installed in the imperial temples that they built for the worship of the Caesars. They hid the gadgetry, though, from view, the pipes, the pulleys, the counterweights, the pressurized tubes, sealed steam chambers. They hid them all below the floors and behind the walls of the temples. I want you to imagine a crowd of worshipers show up. The priests go through their duties, lifting up prayers to the emperors, reciting their liturgy, praying that the divine Caesars would bless the people. And now the priests urge the people to praise the emperor more loudly. Their cries become a chant. And once they've satisfied the priests with their show of devotion, there's a signal given by one of the priests, and the engines beneath the temple floor go to work. And the statues of the imperial family begin to appear to levitate. A fire appears out of nowhere and consumes the sacrifice on the altar. A fountain spews water in a graceful arc. Dancing figures appear. The sound of thunder cascades from underneath the imperial throne, and statues of the old Greco-Roman gods bow their heads in deference to the emperors. The audience stands amazed at these marvels, women covering their mouths and men falling on their knees and sobbing and thanking God, their gods, that they had lived to see the day of miracles. The reverie, though, is interrupted. There's a great voice emanating from the emperor's statue. It's the emperor himself, the crowd thinks, suddenly animating that statue. In fact, though, it's a voice coming from beneath the floor, where a priest of the emperor sits speaking into a hollow tube that snakes up through the statue and into its mouth. The voice commands the people to worship him alone and promises blessings upon their family, rain from heaven, crops from earth, fertility in the home, good omens in the sky. The shell-shocked crowd, awed into submission, stands and whispers, "Who is like the Caesars? And who can wage war with them?" The priest dismisses the people. Imagine that a mother takes her child to the statue of Artemis. And the mother puts a coin in the child's hand. On one side of the coin is the image of Dea Romana, riding a great wolf, standing in the Tiber, surrounded by the seven hills of Rome. And on the other side of the coin is the impress of the Caesar's head with rays of sun streaming from his head, which signifies his divine nature. To use this coin, whether it's to buy or sell food in the marketplace, is implicit assent to the coin's declaration that Caesar is Lord, and to him every knee shall bow. The young woman prods her frightened child standing in the shadow of Artemis. And the child holds the drachma, the coin, and reluctantly puts it into the statue's hand. The coin rolls into a slit in the palm and disappears in a slot in the elbow. And for the child's receipt, here's what the vending machine gives: a teardrop sliding out of the idol's eye and rolling down her cheek. Hear again the voice of the New Testament prophet, long before the farce was uncovered by the public. John foresaw these kinds of machinations, and he declared, "The dragon has been given power to the beast to perform wonders, to call down fire, to speak blasphemies." In other words, as John saw it, the imperial cult, the priesthood, was giving power to the images of the emperors and making them out to be gods. Rome poured its energies into communicating the propaganda of the Caesars through impressive architecture. And in its propaganda, Rome was symbolized by the goddess, as I mentioned a moment ago, Dea Romana, a woman riding a beast. Her divine husband was the reigning Caesar, standing astride the earth and sea, one foot on land, the other in the sea. In every temple, there was a statue of Nike, a goddess of victory, holding a palm branch in one hand and a crown of victory in the other, which she bestows upon the victor. Her constant presence throughout the empire was a constant reminder that Rome was number one. To be part of Rome is to become an overcomer, a conqueror, a victor. John's revelation takes Rome's own propaganda, turns it upside down. He pulls the veil aside in heaven and shows that Rome's pretensions to messianic power are just a comical parody of the true power that resides in the heavens. Dea Romana is merely Rome's vulgar attempt to achieve the majesty of the Holy Bride of Christ. Rome is the great victor, or the ho nikon, or the victor, the overcomer. It's just a tragic farce. In fact, it's a parody of the true overcomer, Jesus of Nazareth, who has overcome the world. Moreover, instead of Rome being number one and holding the palm branch in one hand and wearing a crown of victory upon its head, John says it will be the saints of Christ who hold the palm branch in one hand and wear the victor's crown. Satan prepares a messianic imitation each and every generation, awaiting the final showdown when the Lord Jesus suddenly descends with a shout. And as it was then, so it is now. In every age, the enemy of our soul offers an alternative Messiah, an alternative Shema, an alternative priesthood, an alternative eternal city, an alternative peace, an alternative salvation. In a word, our enemy is always in the business of crafting a religion of victory, a religion that appeals to our pride, a religion that flatters us, a religion in which only winners need to apply. But we are not ignorant of Satan's devices. We have the holy word of God and the testimony of the saints. The early Christians simply outlasted the empire as the water of a river quietly outlasts the jagged boulder that lies in its path, imperceptibly wearing it away by steady persistence over a period of centuries. When we think back on how the faith overcame the empire, we sometimes imagine that Christianity grew through massive revivals. And this has something to do with the record in the book of Acts. The Christian physician does record a few mass conversions, but the record of these events merely describes the church's very earliest days and not the second half of the first century. More importantly, the kind of mass conversions that Luke describes seem to have occurred primarily, if not exclusively, in Judea. In point of fact, the church of the second and third centuries grew through more conventional methods. Its growth, though, was so stunning during these centuries that by the time Rome understood what had happened, it was too late for them. The only way Rome of the fourth century could survive the church's silent invasion was by joining it. Now, I want to explain to you for a few minutes how that happened. I mentioned earlier that the Greco-Roman practice gave priority to male children. Females were routinely aborted in utero, or they were exposed, or simply smothered or poisoned after birth and thrown into the city dump. This practice, though, was not confined to the hardened, morally defective few. I want to illustrate this point. I want you to consider the following passage, which I've taken from an ancient letter. It's composed by what I take to be the average family man of Rome of the second century. His name was Hilarion. He was writing to his expecting wife, Alice. Here's what he said. "Know that I'm still in Alexandria, and do not worry if the servants all come back and I remain in Alexandria. I ask and beg you to take good care of our baby son. And as soon as I receive payment, I shall send it up to you. If you are delivered of a child before I come home, if it is a boy, keep it. If it is a girl, discard it. You have sent me word. Don't forget me. How could I ever forget you, Alice? I beg you not to worry about me." I quoted those last couple of sentences, though it went beyond my point, because I want to illustrate for you, as far as men of antiquity go, this is clearly a man of tenderness, a keen romantic sense, even. He was not some Planned Parenthood executive or moral monster, alas, I repeat myself. The child is given the same regard, though, as a cut of beef that's been sitting in the house too long and needs to be thrown out, lest the maggots multiply. Early Christians, though, followed the teachings of Paul and insisted that men and women had equal standing before Christ. Children were not to be aborted. They were a gift from God, whether they were male or female, healthy or deformed. The Didache, which was a late 1st century, early 2nd century Syrian Christian document, explicitly forbids the destruction of the unborn. Chapter 2, verse 2 says, "You shall not abort a child or commit infanticide." There's another 2nd century Christian document called the Epistle of Barnabas. It warns the Christians, "You shall not slay the child by procuring an abortion, nor again shall you destroy it after it's born. You shall not withdraw your hand from your son or from your daughter, but from their infancy you shall teach them the fear of the Lord." Now, I want you to imagine the long-term impact of these kinds of policies. Rome is killing its daughters. Christianity is valuing them. There are roughly 2 or 3 boys for every girl in the Roman Empire. This ratio is unsustainable. It's lethal to civilization. But the situation is even worse than I just described. One can't simply think in terms of the ratio of boys to girls. The ratio needs to account for men to women, not just men to women, but rather the ratio of men to available women. Prostitution and concubinage were so rampant in the empire because some men hoarded women. They would have one wife, a collection of concubines. And then there were so many brothels on every street corner. If you ever go to Pompeii, you'll see the most frequent kind of house there was a brothel. So adjusting for these factors, the ratio of men to marriageable women in the empire were something like 4 men for every available one woman. To say that Greco-Roman men were having great difficulty finding a wife is an understatement. There was no such problem in the early church. In fact, the ratio of Christian men to women seemed to have tilted slightly in favor of women. Where are the Roman men beginning to look for marriageable women in the second and third centuries? In the church. But the church had a strict policy. Christians cannot marry outside the faith. What fellowship does light have with darkness? So, unmarried pagan men often found themselves inclined to listen more patiently to the good news. And so, over a period of 2 centuries, Christianity, strengthened by its teaching, and paganism, enfeebled by its practices, went entirely separate ways socially. Christians had large, healthy families. Pagans had small families. Christian families retained their children and created a center of gravity strong enough to hold multiple generations in its orbit, while the offspring of pagan unions were increasingly detached, the product of non-familial conjugation. Christian children usually lived with an affectionate father, a grandfather, and sometimes a great-grandfather, while often the pagan child, born of a prostitute or concubine, would be lucky to even know who his father was. Parenthetically, the greatest revivals can be found in our own pews, among our children. When Israel was looking for great, strong heroes to lead them out of slavery, God sent them a child floating in a basket down the Nile. When Israel needed deliverance from their enemies, God sent them the baby Samson. When Israel needed deliverance from the Philistines, God sent them the child David. When the world needed salvation and was looking for a strong and mighty Messiah, a babe was born in Bethlehem. When God is about to do something big, he usually starts with the kids. Today, while we might look for that great day when our altars will suddenly be full of sinners waiting to be baptized, a potential revival is already sitting on our pews in the form of our children. The revival that outlasted the Roman Empire was not a sudden revival, but was instead a steady and patient revival. The kind of revival that might take 30 or 60 or 100 years to realize. I don't know if you've noticed, but the ideologies that are hostile to Christianity today generally share one thing in common. The homosexual movement, the transgender movement, the feminist movement, the secular leftist movements, the abortion movement, the pornography movement, the climate change movement. There is a strange and terrible pattern right here. They see children, the reproduction of the human race, as an evil, as a danger to the planet. For the typical millennial, your great-grandmother had 8 children. Your grandmother had 5 children. Your mother had 3 children. But the secular millennial has 2 abortions and a dog. For millions of young, college-educated Americans, life is low-paid drone work at some soulless digital company, punctuated only by brunch on the weekends and Netflix and white wine at night and a bit of pornography to kill natural drives and to avoid having to take any responsibility. Forever. Until they die alone with no descendants to remember them. Why do so many young people view sexual intimacy with the opposite gender with such ambivalence? Pregnancy is a betrayal of the body, and a child is a prison sentence. I'm hearing about all these companies who are now offering to pay for their female employees to cross state lines and have abortion on demand. For the life of me, I can't figure out why. Why? A generation that prides itself on being feminist and woke. A generation that claims to be able to detect forms of oppression in the most innocent expressions somehow can't hear Dick's Sporting Goods essentially telling its low-paid pregnant employees, kill that baby and get back in the kitchen where you belong. This is simply unsustainable. For a movement to last, it has to have children. So these horrible ideologies all have a self-destruct mechanism buried deep within their programming. Those who hate God love death. the scripture says. This is why the secularists are all so desperate to take over the public school system. They don't have children of their own. They want to pass on their madness to ours. Ultimately, the goal is a satanic goal. Satan hates the human race, and he especially hates children. The Lord told Jeremiah, "Build ye houses and dwell in them, and plant gardens and eat the fruit of them." He told them this in Babylon. "Take ye wives and beget sons and daughters, and take wives for your sons and give your daughters to husbands, that they may bear sons and daughters, that ye may be increased there and not diminished. See the peace of the city." In other words, have families. This is a call to the church today. Have families. The early church had a few other traits that contributed to its astonishing success. The church was not afraid of death. As an illustration, I want you to consider the difference between the names the Christian and the pagan gave their respective graveyards. The pagan Romans referred to their graveyards as a necropolis, or a city of the dead. For them, the grave was a place of permanent separation. In typical Roman artwork on their sarcophagi, depict people being painfully and permanently separated by the gods of death. When one died, one could expect to go to a cold, lonely Hades, where one would live out an eternity in a disembodied state. The Christian, though, believed that this life was often the place of alienation and suffering. But the next would be a life of intimacy with God and family and the saints. So the Christians never referred to their grave as a city of the dead. They called their graveyard a koimeterion, or cemetery, which means the sleeping place. We don't go there to die, we sleep. "We shall not all sleep," Paul said. For Christians, death meant rest, not separation. Once a plague descended upon the city of Alexandria in the early 3rd century, wiped out half the population, sending most of the rest to their sickbed. Imagine, coronavirus times 10. As the casualties of the city mounted, the world's leading expert on medicine, Galen, ran for his life and abandoned the people he should have had the fortitude to heal. The Christians in that city were a small and persecuted and isolated minority, but when the plague came, they came out of hiding and were the only people in the city willing to tend to the sick. They showed no fear, not just because they believed that Jesus was a healer, but even if he didn't heal them, what could death do to them? What could a stingless death do? Unlike the pagans, the Christians lived with death on a daily basis. And during this crisis, the Christians built the world's first hospital system. They nursed thousands of pagans back to health. And when the plague was gone and the dead were buried and the living were whole again, the Alexandrians marveled at their Christian benefactors, the people they had once loathed. And like a weed living in a dark prison, turning towards a stray beam of light, trying to solve the enigma of its existence, pagan Alexandria turned towards Christianity. Here was light. Something different had entered the world. The Christians had single-handedly saved this ancient and great city, and Alexandria never forgot them. And it became Christian long before Rome did. Alas, our ancient enemy is still at work. Hieron of Alexandria is very much with us today. Or perhaps we would call him Hieron of Silicon Valley. He still designs technical marvels in the service of the worship of the state. We have our own secular science priestcraft intent on enforcement. But the same Spirit who said to John, "Come up here, and I shall show you that which shall take place hereafter," makes the same invitation to the faithful today. From the perspective of the throne of God and of the Lamb, secularism and scientism have all but died already and are being propped up by their mutual rigor mortis. What does applied postmodernism have to show for itself? How about the gender studies cul-de-sac, gender dysphoria, secular doctrines with no limiting principles? Secularism has made life in the modern world so unbearable for so many that the official emotion of the 21st century is anxiety, with loneliness as a close second. Man shall not live by bread alone, but by an endless supply of drugs, our culture says. This world's too much for you, the world says. Here, take this pill we've engineered to help mollify the problems that we created. Israel followed a holy cloud through the wilderness. The cloud that modern man follows might fitly be described as a cloud of narcotics. We have justice in our world without virtue, peace without love, sin without forgiveness, sleep without rest, matrimony without holiness, time without eternity. Rest in peace, young prince. The wolf is on his way. This is a dark world. It's been said that there are many ways we can hold off the darkness, but not for long. Eventually, the lights of our lives, love, health, intelligence, work, competence, political, economic stability, will go out one by one. And when that happens, we'll need more than our cold secular baubles and trinkets. Our weeping, our Christian weeping, will endure for a night, but joy is coming for us in the morning. And for those of us not bound by the tyranny of the present, the secular victory can only be ephemeral and will amount to little more than a pop gun fired at an army that won the war 20 centuries ago. From the perspective of eternity, the kingdom of God thunders in the skies and has come to the earth already and flung open its gates. But yet the secular critics sit like two toads on the bank of a muddy pond croaking, "We've won, we've won." Now, the secularist assumes that Christianity has been rendered obsolete, superseded by science and reason. But who does the modern scoffer think we are? A resistance formed last week? Or last century? Or last millennium? No. We have stared down bigger, badder, more determined foes before. If we weren't extinguished when there were just a handful of us against the entire Roman Empire, what hope can our enemy possibly have, as the name of Christ is declared in every nation? Even if every last one of us were buried deep in the earth, let our enemy see to it that he guards our tombs and seals them shut and cover the valley of our dry bones in miles of dirt. But still, beware, for all it will take would be for one man with the word of God to stand and breathe upon us. I've been hearing for a few decades now that the church is dying. The enemies of God had better hope not. There is no place in the universe the church is more lethal than the grave. The grave is our country of birth. Secularism was born in the gentle shade of a Christian culture in Parisian cafes. But Christianity was conceived not upon the bed of leisure. We were conceived on a cross. We were delivered in a tomb. We were born in the dark. We learned to speak on Pentecost while the world mocked us. We took our first steps under the reign of Roman stones. We were raised in the catacombs, and we were educated in the lion's mouth. We became men at the stake. Do you imagine you can invent a few toys, make a few gadgets, and propose a few philosophies, take over a few hundred college campuses, win a few elections, confuse a few generations, and we're just going to suddenly go away? We've been called irrelevant since Calvary. And we will be called irrelevant right up to the moment that the trumpet sounds. There have been Christians like Paul and Peter and John and Stephen and Polycarp and Praxias and Phoebe and Antipas for whom it would have been easier to rope the sun and turn it in reverse course than to turn them from the course of truth and honor. They spoke the truth as unhesitatingly with the axe suspended above their neck as when they spoke in the safety of their small gatherings. And we are their children. Apostolics made of the same stuff and filled with the same spirit and baptized in the same saving name. While the world recruits its emissaries from among the healthy, socially adjusted winners, the Christian faith has always raised its force from the rebel. Not many wise, not many mighty, not many noble. Our cornerstone is the stone that the builders rejected. But when the secular dreams and idols inevitably become mere museum pieces, set next to Aphrodite and Horus and Zeus, the church will still be thundering through the ages. I conclude. In the spring of 2011, as an American seminary student, I found myself standing on the Areopagus, Mars Hill, the same formation of rock where the Apostle Paul stood and delivered a warning to Athens, Epicureans, and Stoics. It was a cool Sunday morning just before dawn. I had been asked to give a devotional to my fellow seminarians at daylight. I remember I was really nervous to begin with, and then tourists from outside the group started gathering around and listening in, which really helped my nerves. And I finished, the group dissipated. I was left alone for a few minutes to explore that ancient hill. The sun had now come up several degrees above the horizon, and then all at once, church bells rang across the city below, from borough to borough, from waterfront to Acropolis. Athens came to life. The sound was deafening, hauntingly beautiful. 1,000 churches, literally, announcing that it was Sunday, the day that Christ rose from the grave. 20 centuries earlier, when Paul was here, there were no churches, much less bells to ring in a Sunday morn. The city acknowledged its gods and worshiped them in acts of stunning artistry. The Parthenon atop the Acropolis, erected in honor of Athens, Athena, one of the 7 wonders of the world. Everywhere you looked, there were monuments so vast and luxurious that Athenians had no need to persuade its citizens to worship if a stranger were to ask them then if Athena were real. They could merely point to the Parthenon and say, could something that doesn't exist inspire that? It was into this atmosphere that Paul, a solitary Jew, having not a single monument except a wooden cross to point to as evidence of the truth he spoke, bearing only the words and testimony of his mouth. And he stood on this hill and lectured the very religious Athenians on the subject of religion. And he must have made quite a spectacle on that day. The philosophers called him Spermologus, or babbler, an insult both then and now. He seemed to be as far away from relevance as one can be, and they laughed at him. The nearby Parthenon cast a menacing shadow over Paul. Who could have guessed that 2 centuries from that moment, this insignificant Jew and the Lord he worshipped would dominate this city? Who then could have guessed that the Parthenon would soon be nothing more than a museum, a crumbling monument to ancient superstition? I've also visited the Mamertine prison, the place where Paul is believed to have lived his last day. He seems to have been lowered through a hole in the floor, the same hole through which guards could also use to slide buckets through for food and waste. And he was lowered 11 feet below onto a stone dungeon floor. The world he once roamed free was now reduced to a few feet of cold earth, and his circle of friends, once robust, dwindled by the day as death hung overhead. Paul died after the fashion of his master, alone. But how satisfying it would have been for Paul, I thought, the man who lived between the lightning of the resurrection and the thunder of his Lord's return, to hear these bells ringing today, and to know that Athens' Christians, nominal or otherwise, now outnumber the worshipers of Athena roughly 3 million to 0. Come, let us mock at the great, who had such burdens on the mind and toiled so hard and late to leave some monument behind. And before descending the stairs to leave the Areopagus, I took one last look around. When Paul was here, the Stoics and Epicureans were the dominant culture influencers of the day. They were regarded as the future, the only 2 viable worldviews. As I took those stairs, listening to the bells that were still ringing, I could hear the voice of the apostle whom men called Tiny, the man who received a revelation on the road to Damascus that he would not die of old age. I hear him speaking just above the din of the scoffing philosophers. Where is the philosopher today? Where is the scribe? Where is the disputer of this world? Hath not God made foolish the wisdom of this world? As I looked all around at the ruins. And where are they today? These philosophies and religions for winners are long gone. And the Neros, the Nero who executed Paul, what about him? Hey, we call our dogs Nero and our sons Paul today. So now to the one who is able to keep us from falling and to present us faultless before the presence of his glory with exceeding joy. To the only wise God, our Savior, be glory and majesty, dominion and power, both now and forever. And it's only a matter of time before the heavenly song the ancient Christian prophet heard is fulfilled. The kingdoms of our Lord. Hear me, I want you to hear this, and I want you to go out repeating it. The kingdoms of this world have become the kingdoms of our Lord and of his Christ. And he shall reign forever. Forever. Alex was right. Brother Weber preached on our heritage last night. And I'm speaking of that heritage too. This is your legacy. Never leave it. For you will be picking up the temporal for the eternal. Cherish it. Know it. Pass it down. Build families and build churches and be on a mission every day. The Lord is with us now and always. Come pray with me. Come pray. We exalt you, Lord. Strengthen our families and our homes. Teach me how to teach my children. My families be apostolic for generations and generations and generations until you come.
May his favor be upon you and a thousand generations, and your family, and your children, and their children, and their children. His presence go before you and behind you and beside you, all around you and within you. He is with you, he is with you.
And their children, and his presence go before. Would you close your eyes and just lift your hands?